This is episode 3 of the Living Reminders.
2% doesn't sound like much. But 2% of the entire planet, of every person on it, that's more than the world's 10 largest cities combined. It's 140 million people. And like that, they were gone.
All the way from Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders. It's a podcast dedicated to the show The Leftovers on HBO. We're still here, and so are you. So let's talk about Penguin One, Us Zero. Suddenly I'm hidden. It's the darkness of the dawn. Welcome to episode 3 of The Living Reminders. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name is Blake, and I wish I was in half as good a shape as Justin Theroux.
Hot damn, even Meg said he was a hot cop.
Oh my God, where? How do you even do that? How many steroids is this guy taking?
No, he just probably eats a lot of protein, zero carbs, no chocolate chip pancakes. I mean, he is not eating what the guilty remnants are eating for breakfast.
What? But by the way, what are those people eating? It looked like slop.
Not at Meg's house. In the house, they have pancakes and stuff. No wonder she's been there for weeks.
I was talking about the first episode when they had that bowl of like
oh, that looked
crap.
Like oatmeal.
No, that was like...
That looks like the oatmeal when I make it.
You know what that... You know what it reminded me of? Remember the slop that they ate in The Matrix? And they're like, oh yeah, it has two parts protein, just enough for the humans to survive. That's what it reminded me of.
That's probably what it was. You're right.
But those pancakes look great with the smiley face and the whipped cream. So what'd you think about this episode, darling?
Oh, man. I liked it. I think I liked it more than I liked the first episode because I hadn't seen any of this.
Yeah.
That was my main complaint with the first episode is that I pretty much saw all of it in the trailer and everything leading up to it.
And I was happy that they actually chose to do that because they showed only the first episode in that first trailer, the one that they kept playing over and over and over again on HBO. So you didn't know anything that was going to happen. And even the trailer they showed after the pilot, it didn't really show a whole lot from this particular episode. It just showed a kind of a broad stroke of the entire season. So you were left in the mystery with those characters, and I was really happy about that. But for me, I liked this episode. I thought it was good. I liked the show. I'm not in love with it. And Allison Keene of Collider.com, she had written this on her recap that I happened to read this morning. And I think she is right when she says that her reaction to the show confuses her. She doesn't necessarily like it, but it actually sticks with her throughout the week, which is a rarity, I guess, for her. And I'm going to say the same thing. I'm going to echo that. This show sticks with me. I find myself thinking about it, kind of like how I thought about Breaking Bad, or kind of like how I thought about Lost. Just thinking about the imagery and the symbolism that Lindelof and Perrotta are trying to use throughout the show. Now, I'm not going to get into details now, but we'll get to that later on.
The thing that sticks with me is that I'm not being spoon-fed anything. I'm not laughing a lot. Mm-hmm. At Breaking Bad, you got to have the comical character, and I don't
Jesse.
I don't have a comical character. And this, I'm usually very upbeat, optimistic person, mm-hmm. and I haven't found anything that I love in the show. It's interesting that you said that you're not in love with this show yet. For me, it's not that. It's that the optimist in me hasn't found the Hurley. Hasn't found the Jesse Pinkman, hasn't found this character that is going to spoon feed all the information that people like me might miss, that is going to give me hope, that's going to find the big jar of peanut butter and ranch dressing.
Yeah, there's no line like,
Gatorade me, bitch.
There hasn't been anything like that
yet. And I think if there is anything like that, it's the teenagers. It might be the ping pong guys. I don't know. But on the other hand, I think that's why like this show is supposed to make you uneasy. This show is supposed to be sad. The whole point of it is that nobody gets what's going on mm-hmm. and people are upset. So I agree with you. I'm not in love with this show, but I think that's because I'm uneasy. And I think that that is what the show writers are intending. I'm going back and watching, and I'm feeling along with these characters. I'm very frustrated at some of these characters.
Yeah, you're tense. I always feel like, after you watch this show, you are tired. Yeah. Like, you are emotionally drained.
Well, it doesn't help that it's at 10 o'clock at night.
I know. It's.
They need to bump that up
because
I am sleepy.
Oh, my God. 10 o'clock at night? True, who gives a crap about True Blood? Who, like, honestly, come on now. What are we doing here?
Some people do.
That show sucks.
So, speaking about sucks, we sucked because we forgot to talk about some things last week.
Yes, yes. And I wanted to bring up an interview with Damon Lindelof. Some guy asked him about the animals.
What
about
animals?
The dogs and the deer and everything. He made a great point. He says there does seem to be some sort of hiccup or disturbance in the way that the animals, particularly dogs, are behaving in the wake of the sudden departure. I think that the natural world is represented by animals, and they're trying to use the animals to kind of play into this idea of, and are the animals in on a secret that the humans are not?
Oh, I totally believe that. You know, when like a hurricane's coming and the birds are all flying and the squirrels are acting like crazy nuts?
Yep.
Get it? I totally believe this. And when that guy said, or when the woman, I forget who it was, that said when the owners disappeared, it messed up the dogs. I totally believe that. It messed up the people. Mm-hmm. But the people have to wear these masks and try to get on with the life. So I love that they're doing this to the animals.
And as for the deer that kept popping up, Justin Theroux, the guy who plays Kevin Garvey, he says that in some sense, the stag, the deer, has to be some kind of, for lack of a better word, a spirit animal.
A Patronus. Let's just say it, Justin. A Patronus.
Let's just get one more Harry Potter reference in the Living Reminders. Okay? Mark it down. Number one.
You're a wizard, Harry.
He says that it's something that represents strength and grace and survival.
Patronus.
And he doesn't know what... Number two.
You're a wizard, Harry.
And he doesn't know what it means in a larger sense of the show, but there is something definitely spiritual afoot. Notice that he didn't say religion or Catholic or whatever. He just said spiritual. And I think that, again, to keep pushing this, that this is not a religious show. It's just full of spirit and faith.
They're also not saying it's a crazy thing, which is interesting that they use that word spiritual and not, oh, is the deer there? Mm-hmm. They're saying it's something secret, something spiritual.
Hmm. And a small thing, and this is training from Lost, and I apologize for this. Damon Lindelof has taught me to do this. I watch and look at everything, and I can't believe I missed this, but upon my third rewatch of the pilot, I noticed that Tom was reading The Stranger. Now, The Stranger is written by Albert Camus, who is a famous writer who believed in existentialism, and...
You're speaking in very big words for me.
Okay. So ultimately, Albert Camus wrote this book called The Stranger, and in the book, there's a guy, and he goes to his mother's funeral. He doesn't really pay attention to the mother's funeral. Eventually, he ends up killing some dude randomly in French Algiers, okay? This guy eventually gets brought into court, gets sentenced to death, and then the chaplain goes to visit him in jail, and the chaplain begs the killer, please find your faith in God so that you can move on and enjoy the afterlife. And the killer says no. It says, I don't care about God. And he finally understands that humans are just indifferent. They're just people. They're here. There's no particular lovely beauty about life. It's just, we're here. And he finds no relationship with God. And I think that's what's happening with Tom.
He's really sad. He needs to read a happier book. Gosh.
It's a sad book.
It's a sad show, man.
Well, existentialism kind of sucks. Well, no, it doesn't suck, but it's Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill, letting it fall back down again. It's all, we're just here because we're here, dude, and there's no real particular meaning other than we're just pushing the rock up the hill. That's what it's about.
All right. A couple of things we're going to really breeze by. There was the praying at the school, which we kind of glossed over, how some people didn't really care about the Pledge of Allegiance to the country, but then a lot of people were interested in the prayer.
Yeah.
And then the tattoos. You wanted to talk about these tattoos.
The tattoos on Justin Theroux's back. Now, this is a problem that Damon Lindelof has given me once again. I looked into this because I wanted to know what the tattoos meant. They're actually Justin Theroux's real tattoos. His real tattoos on his back. That whole thing?
Yeah.
Totally real. It's unbelievable.
You don't read Us Weekly.
No, I don't.
Yeah, you haven't seen his back before.
I haven't. Sorry.
Do you know who he's with?
Oh, yeah, Jennifer Aniston.
Yeah, so there's a lot of pictures.
You know, the man has too much. He's dating Jennifer Aniston. He's on a show with Amy Brenneman and Liv Tyler. They're always by his side. They're always laughing and like flirting. The man's just got too much.
He's just lucky.
Oh my God. All right, let's get into the recap. It's time to reheat the leftovers.
Okay, so let's start off with what happened this week on Penguin 1, Us 0. So we start off actually hearing a bit about Wayne and how people are going to like go after him.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard them say that he has been convicted of statutory rape.
Yeah, because he's got all these young Asian girls. That's what now we've discovered who the Asian girls are. It's his little harem.
Yeah, I had no idea they were that young. So Wayne is totally on my crap list.
He is a creep, man. He is a total creep.
I mean, he was creepy before, but now that I heard that, I am just all set with Wayne.
You don't like the fact that he's bopping little Asian girls?
No, I thought they were women. I thought they were young women. Uh-huh. You know, Asian women actually quite often get to look a lot younger than they are. They have some wonderful genetics, and I didn't know that they were that young, so I'm pretty upset. And then, who did you say these SWAT team members are?
Oh, yeah, this is ATFEC. Now, I didn't know what ATFEC meant, and it's ATFEC. I saw this on the back of their shirts. I'm like, what the hell is this group? Because you didn't know who the people were that were talking about Holy Wayne in the beginning. You figured that they were government people, but you didn't know what they were. So I didn't know what the hell it was. And later on, the next day, I was on Twitter, and I happened to see this lady, Kathy Lingenfelter, who is a writer on the show. Now, she's a great resource for Twitter during the show, because she gives off these little tidbits of information. We'll give them as our episode goes along here. But the first one she gave was these ATFEC people. What it stands for is alcohol, tobacco, firearms, explosives, and cults, which must have... I know the ATF exists right now, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, but this must be like an addendum or an amendment to the ATF after everybody departed on October 14th.
Well, they need to end that. Actually, they need to add two more letters, AG, Asian girls, because did you notice they came and they just started shooting all these Asian girls? Oh. And I felt terrible because it's like, they don't have guns. They have gummy worms. They have gummy worms and string bikinis. They are very mean. ATFEC, I'm just going to call them SWAT team, even though it's not what they were. I did not like them.
They went in there just to kill everybody. They didn't want to negotiate. They didn't want to do anything. They went in there with a purpose just to end Holy
Wayne. For him to ask Christine, are you ready to die? Who says that?
I know.
Why are you saying this young girl? So I don't know I don't understand the military guy's perspective and why they were sent there supposedly to get Wayne. So why are you trying to scare and shoot all these young women? I'm just all set
and
with
the other
them.
Thing too I like about this was I loved these people's logic in going to get Wayne. They're like, oh, well, you know, a congressman went to go see him, so he must be pose a threat to national security. Hey, let's just go on there and kill everybody.
I mean, I watch The House of Cards, so I believe, you know, you got to be careful with some of those congressmen.
And the other thing I loved that he said, too, was that the thing that he does is magic fucking hugs. Like, that's what they were proclaiming.
We got to see one of those happened.
Almost happened.
So it cuts from this. And we actually get an opening sequence.
Wasn't it great?
The frescoes.
Oh.
Absolutely gorgeous and mm-hmm. so haunting. And while we're watching it, it almost looks like they move. And that's the great thing sometimes with paintings that are painted on curved canvases. Mm-hmm. You know, is you can look at it and it can almost look like they are moving away. And I just absolutely loved the depictions of these characters and how creepily the music was. And mm-hmm. I know that it's Max Richter, but in this particular moment, I felt like I was listening to Danny Elfman.
Really?
Yeah.
Danny Elfman of what fame?
Edward Scissorhands.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yes. You know, and Tim
Burton. Not everybody is a music nerd like us.
Yes. He also wrote the music to The Simpsons. But that's, you know, so if you think of Tim Burton movies and Edward Scissorhands and these kind of haunting piano melodies, it kind of, that's what it brought me back to, which is beautiful. And I was so excited there is an opening sequence and it's gorgeous. And I love how it's something that is painted because that's what you often do when you memorialize someone.
And HBO always has these great opening sequences. We all know Game of Thrones. One of the other underrated ones is the show Rome. I loved Rome, and it's actually very similar to the opening sequence of this show with all the different paintings moving and interacting with its environments. Really cool opening. Loved the music. Max Richter, you are hitting it out of the park on this one.
So Kevin wakes up after this beautiful sequence, and he has this dream where he's hanging out with his daughter's hot friend Amy.
Oh, God. I just felt dirty watching this scene.
Yeah, that was not okay. She takes him to the woods and they see this crazy, you know, the guy that shoots dogs.
Yeah, by the way, no one was wearing a shirt, by the way. Did you notice that?
Was she wearing a shirt?
Well, no, she was wearing a shirt, but like he wasn't wearing a shirt. That's why I know he's in such good shape. But they weren't. He wasn't wearing a shirt. She was wearing this skimpy little shirt. And I was also noticing, too, this lady, Katherine Lingenfelter, that the actors actually walked barefoot in these sub-zero temps when they were shooting it in February. Like, they were out there in the cold.
God bless them.
Oh, my God.
I would definitely want some moccasins for that. So he in the dream, Kevin is on fire a little bit, and he actually wakes up to find that there is a fire outside, and it's his neighbors who are, like, burning... What was it? His brother's stuff, because they didn't want to give it away. So I was just so grossed out. There was not too much to this scene. I mean, it's 3 years later. I understand some people keep loved ones close for a very long time. I was just grossed out that he stood on some person's fake teeth.
Oh, I know. And okay, that must have hurt, number one. And then number two, why are you keeping someone's teeth?
I stepped in dog poop barefoot this week. It was disgusting.
It's a long story.
It is a long story. But let me just tell you that when I heard that squish and you see his foot, I was like, oh my God, I stepped in dog poop too. And then instead it was fake teeth. And that's got me beat.
Oh.
That's just really nasty. I don't know what's worst. So poor Kevin, you know, after stepping in fake teeth and dealing with this, he goes to see a really terrible therapist.
I know. Doesn't even know the guy's the wife of Kevin. Like, doesn't even remember the name. He calls her like Libby or something stupid.
What a jerk.
Ugh.
And he has a stupid penguin next to him.
It's the penguin sighting.
So he says that sometimes it helps kids with aggression. This weird penguin. I don't know.
What do you think Lindelof is trying to say to us? Because he clearly titles the episode Penguin 1, Us 0. Is he trying to screw with us? Be like, nah.
Well, that penguin kind of reminded me, you know how he said that sometimes kids take aggression? Do you remember the punching bag balloons that you had as kids?
Yes.
And they're weighted. There's some sand in the bottom. I bet you that's what that kind of penguin is. You know, and it lets at least the kids are getting the aggression out. I think the adults need to start getting aggression out. I don't know what this penguin business is. But I hated this snarky therapist. I wanted to punch the therapist. I wanted to punch the penguin. I just couldn't take him.
I liked what... The fact that Kevin stood up for himself, though. The therapist is calling Loria's ex-wife, and he's like, nah, she's still my wife. And he still considers himself married. I love that. And of course, as he's saying that, they're having those quick cuts to the dogs.
Yep.
Attacking the deer. So I wonder if there's something at play there, if it's just Kevin losing his mind as he's talking about his wife, thinking about his own innocence being eaten or whatever, because he was saying that the stag represents the beauty and the natural part of himself. So I wonder if that's that part of him leaving himself and admitting to the fact that he's not married, his life is not the same anymore, and it's just falling apart around him. That's why he's at this therapist, even though he hates to go there.
He's like Snape, saying goodbye to the doe.
Oh.
You're a wizard, Harry.
Three. That's the third one.
Liv Tyler. Hot damn. Girlfriend has some gorgeous eyes. When they had that opening shot of her about to eat her pancakes... in the frat house, she's just so pretty, and I'm really happy that she's in this role because I absolutely love her. So I love that in the regular houses for the guilty remnants, they get that slop, that oatmeal looking stuff.
Yep.
But she gets pancakes with whipped cream.
Yeah, well, this is what's called the pledge house. These are for all the new members who are getting in there. They're not full members yet. They're just kind of like the tryout period.
Okay.
So they're trying to ease them in, and that's why they get a better living quarters.
They get to talk.
They don't have to wear white all the time, and they're not being forced to smoke. If you notice that, Liv Tyler asks for a cigarette butt, and Lori's like, nah, you're not having one.
Well, they're crappy cigarettes anyway, yeah, so don't worry, Meg.
Yeah, who wants them?
I loved the cranky guy in the robe.
Oh, yeah. That's the guy from King of Queens.
Oh, I loved him.
That's the buddy from King of Queens, I think. I could swear to God that was him.
I just love that he was making the pancakes. He made a little happy face. He just talks. It was a lot of fun.
And a lot of the references that he made in this, he's like, oh, you can't get these pancakes in the big house. And then the guy walks in with the laundry. He's like, oh, man, fucking laundry again? Come on, whatever. And as he's saying all this, I'm thinking, what is this, jail? Like, the laundry, you can't get this in the big house, everything's kind of restricted. Is this Lindelof's way of saying that these people are no good? This is they're being held there. Even though they think they're being there for their own accord, they're really not. It's kind of like jail.
I think of it like rush week, or when you do have your pledgelings. Being in a sorority myself, I know that sometimes in sororities, you really make your pledges do bad, dirty work. Mm-hmm. You know, you would make them do your laundry. I never made anyone do laundry, but I know in some sororities, they would text pledges halfway through class and say, hey, you need to pick me up some cigarettes. I'm here. Mm-hmm. So I bet you that's what it's like. You know, they're making them do this busy work in the midst of their training,
yep.
Which Meg eventually does in the woods. But before we get to that, we see this one scene where there is a guilty remnant and she's painting, and then she gets thrown a slushy on her.
I know. Just the reds. The red slushy.
It reminded me of Glee. Remember how in especially the first season, They always like slushied the nerds?
Yeah.
I kind of wanted that woman to turn around and start singing some kind of song, you know? And just break out in a cappella.
Oh my God. No, that was really cool. And then the guy is just like, hey, loony, F you! You know, like, that shows the kind of relationship that the GR has with these normal people.
They get slushied. Just like Glee.
Yeah.
So then we get cut to Jill, who's at the coffee shop with her friend Amy. Mm-hmm. And Jill gets to check out Nora, who is the woman who lost all of her family.
Yep.
Inside Nora's purse is a pistol. Now, I don't know why Jill's making such a big deal of this. She and Amy are just like, oh my gosh.
It's a gun.
She has a gun.
It's not some bullshit lady gun either.
No, but like lots of people have guns.
Yeah.
It is one of our rights to bear arms.
Yeah, that's true, but you wouldn't expect someone like Nora. She's kind of like innocent and kind of frail.
Didn't your mom have a gun?
Oh, my mom definitely had. She had two guns.
See, and your mom was a frail
little
woman.
Oh, like a
little
tiny woman. I agree. Yeah.
So,
I agree.
You know, when I saw this, I saw Nora with the gun. I'm thinking to The Blind Side, Sandra Bullock's character had a gun. Mm-hmm. I know that your mom had a gun. Mm-hmm. I know lots of little women. I think especially this woman is single now. You know, her husband is gone. She's by herself. It's a really crazy world right now. Yeah. So it makes sense in my opinion.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it because she needs it for protection, or is it because she's going to use it on herself?
I don't know.
And maybe is that like the thing that she has to like remind her that her life has fallen apart and one day she's going to use it and one day it's going to be on herself.
Whatever it is, it's up to Nora. And I just thought that Jill and Amy were just way too snoopy, and you don't want to be snoopy with someone with a gun.
Mm-hmm.
These girlfriends gonna get with the picture. But the weird thing that stood out to me in this scene, it wasn't Jill and Amy being too nosy.
Mm-hmm.
Nora takes her coffee cup and purposefully pushes it off the table so that the coffee mug breaks.
I know. Is it because she wants someone to feel bad for her? You can clearly tell that everybody is on tiptoes or eggshells around her, because the guy's like, oh, what the hell? Come on. And then he sees that it's Nora Durst. And he's like, oh, Mrs. Durst, I'm sorry. Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. Don't even. And she didn't even pay for the coffee or anything. Didn't pay nothing. She just walked away and she's like, oh, it's okay. No problem. I'm so sorry. Is she just testing everybody? Is that why she does it?
I don't know. I saw it. I mean, maybe she's testing. I saw it as just that she is that messed up. Where she's just like, I'm going to break this. Because everything's broken. Yeah, I just think she's that messed up. I don't think she was trying to test anybody. However, you know, we go out and Jill and Amy meet up with ping pong boys in their Prius.
Yep.
And they follow Nora, who has stick figures on the back of her car. Oh. Stick figure families.
Okay, first of all, I hate those goddamn things. I hate them.
She should scratch off the faces because half of her family's disappeared.
Well, that's the thing. Because eventually you end up seeing the fact that she has those CDs in the car, the Chipmunks.
I love the Chipmunks.
Oh, my God.
When I saw that, I was so excited.
Oh,
I love the Chipmunks movie.
For those of you who don't know, Mary has an unhealthy obsession with the Chipmunk movies, like Chipwrecked and all of them.
And the Squeakquel.
The Squeakquel. I don't even know. Have there been like four or five Chipmunk movies?
There's only three.
Whatever. They're all terrible. They all suck.
When the Chipettes come out and they sing, oh, my single ladies, oh, my single ladies. Anyway, so okay, they have the Chipmunk CD.
Hold on. Before we move on, I also wanted to point this out. It was a small thing. Jill and Amy see Nora walking out of the cafe. And as she's walking out, she's like, oh my God, it's the Reverend Matt. It's Eccleston. And she's like, oh, she's going to pop Father Nutballs. but she doesn't pop him. She hugs him. Like, yeah, they know each other. They're cool with each other.
He's probably her local pastor, and he's been making her feel better. I would hug him, too.
It was a small throwaway scene, but I'm telling you, there's something much larger there. This is going to be a big deal.
Okay,
I'm sorry. Let's get back to the chipmunks.
Okay, no, let's get back to the twins. I love the ping pong boys. I think that they are the Hurleys or the Jesse Pinkmans. I think they are our comic relief. They give a little bit of insight. They did that last week when they talked about the dogs. So I'm a big fan of these ping pong boys.
Major friend zone. Huge friend zone with these guys.
I don't think so. I think Jill might, she might.
She might give it to one of them?
Hey, yeah.
I don't know. I see some serious friend zone. It's got all like the trappings of friend zone.
Hey,
let's drive my
Jill.
Prius.
I'm going to root for Jill. Amy might just be friend zone, but we know what Amy does.
Oh, good.
So Nora goes to this elderly couple's house and she starts asking them these questions. Supposedly what happens is if you had someone who departed, you are going to be given a large hefty check. You just have to answer, what was it, 150 questions or something
like
that.
Okay, first of all, 150 questions, really? Like, what is that? And the questions themselves are so weird. Does he have any food allergies? Did they travel to Brazil? Do they enjoy cooking? Sorry, that's our cat in the background. Hold on.
No, okay.
So do they enjoy cooking? Do they speak multiple languages? And has he had more than 20 sexual partners? Really? Come on. What is that?
There are lots of questions. I mean, when you have sit down and you've had to fill out a questionnaire, people are trying to figure out if there's any commonalities whatsoever. Mm-hmm. They don't know what it is. To me, I still think it could be aliens. Maybe aliens were looking for people who ate peanut butter sandwiches that day. She's just trying to find commonalities. What I don't know is she official? Is she honestly doing this list because it's a greater thing, or is she doing this on her own? Because if she's doing it on her own and she's asking questions like, has this person had over 20 sexual partners? Her two kids obviously didn't have 20 sexual partners. They were little kids.
Sure.
So I don't know.
But the husband might have.
He might have. We don't know. But we're trying to figure out what these commonalities are. I think it's sad that she has to go through these questions. My question is she doing this on her own accord under the guise that it's an official
thing?
That's
a good idea. I wonder, is it that way of her way of coping with the grief? Just to make up these questions and go to people's houses and say, oh yeah, you're going to get your benefit package. And she records it, but then she doesn't give the benefit package.
Because she might be doing an experiment of her own. She might be trying to figure out the commonalities.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that.
Thank you. That might be my little theory.
Well, you already said it. It's wasted now.
Oh, goodness.
Come up
gracious.
With another one now.
But how sad was that? And she still had to keep asking them about the sexual history. We come back to beautiful Meg, and she's out into the woods, and Lori wants to make her chop down a tree. We don't understand why. I have serious feedback. First, terrible axe, doesn't even look sharp. We don't even know when it was sharpened. And Meg needs gloves.
Yeah.
It's freezing outside and girlfriend's going to get blisters.
Can we talk about this too also? The show, the first pilot took place on October 14th. It was the 3-year anniversary, right?
Yes.
We also got the knowledge that the show, the second one, took place about 3 weeks after October 14th, which puts it probably November 14th-ish. There's snow everywhere. That's like the biggest time jump ever.
No, it's New York. Some parts of New York are very snowy. If you're near like Ithaca, it snows all the time.
Maybe. I don't know. I still feel like that was a lot of snow for 3 weeks later.
It's think about Rhode Island. We've occasionally even gotten snow at Halloween. Okay. So it makes sense that there's that much snow. Okay. But she has a really cool conversation with Lori, and she says something about the cult. You know, something like this cult sucks. Yeah,
you guys are running a shitty cult. That's what she says.
Yeah, that's what she says. And then Lori writes, not a cult, which I thought was pretty interesting because they keep getting defined by others as being a cult. Mm-hmm. And Meg says that she might want to leave. And I think, you know, I'd leave too. The pancakes sound pretty good.
Yep.
It seems like it's a vacation, kind of like a bed and breakfast. Maybe that albino looking guy makes your bed after he does the laundry.
Leave some mints on the pillow for you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it seems like an easy gig.
It sounds like you're a happy remnant.
I was amazed to find out when Meg said, I've been here for weeks.
And tree chopping.
But this is the first time she's tree chopping. Like, what has she been doing all these 3 weeks? What kind of soul searching has she been doing all this time? That's a long time to be away.
It's not like she's talking to anybody from the Guilty Remnant. They ain't talking to her. I mean, she can talk, but nobody else can.
The guy in the robe is talking to her.
King of Queens guy.
goodness. All right. So we switch from this beautiful kind of scene in the woods, and now we get back to finding Wayne. All these dead people. We're taking care of Christine. We get to Wayne. Why does he never have a shirt? Does he think he's Jacob from Twilight? I'm serious. Why doesn't this guy wear a shirt?
I wonder if it's in his contract, like Jacob. He can only wear a shirt for like 3 minutes of the entire show.
Gosh, I'm like, now that I know that he has all these offenses to him and he likes little girls, put on a shirt.
I don't
want to
see
yourself.
I don't want to see you. I don't want to see any of that. Nope, no, no, thank you.
Please.
And I love seeing the contrast between New York and the desert. I thought it was a great juxtaposition. I don't know why. It felt cool to me.
Well, because it reminds you that this happened across the world. I think Mapleton is supposed to be this really small town, and you're supposed to be very intimate and get to know all of these people. And then you're thrown in the desert, and you're reminded that it's not just Mapleton where shit's hitting the fan. Mm-hmm. It's everywhere. And here's this other area where now there's guns, and they're trying to kill young women.
Mm-hmm. I secretly wanted to see, I wanted to see Walter White show up in his his RV and just be like, "Hey, let's cook some meth." You know, it's because that's the last time I seen something with the desert was Breaking Bad. So I was hoping for that one moment, but I guess not.
So we're going to skip back to the GR, to the Guilty Remnants. And they're boarding up the windows now of these McMansions.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother hen, her name's Patty.
Yep.
Hate Patty with a vengeance.
Patty sucks. She's got a bad attitude.
Seriously.
What's up with you, Patty? Have a butt.
Yes, I'm just so all set with her.
Do you think she's angry because she can't talk? You know that. You know what she did in her previous life was all she did was bitch about other people. She bitched about other moms, and she bitched about other kids who were starting ahead of her kid on the soccer team. Guaranteed that's what she did.
I'm all set with her. She's so cranky because Meg's not doing too well, and they think they're going to lose her. One thing that stood out to me, Lori's hair looked fabulous this episode.
Didn't it? It looked way better than the pilot.
Yes, the pilot, her hair looked like she hasn't touched conditioner.
She needed hot oil.
She got a keratin treatment or something because something happened where now it's like curled under. I think maybe she's trying to make Meg feel a little normal. She doesn't want to be too scary. You know, that was the scary look. That was I'm going to haunt you and stalk you with my stringy hair. And now we're going to be buds. And Meg, you're pretty, so I'm going to be pretty too.
Or is Meg making her prettier? Is Meg doing that effect to her and not vice versa? Not like, oh, I'm going to do this for Meg because it's going to make it easier. Is Meg bringing that kind of warmth and verve of life back to Lori?
Maybe. Or maybe just they wanted to make her hair look pretty. Why does Patty care so much about Meg leaving?
I don't know. Maybe because she's got a beef with Lori and she's trying to stick it to her. You know, like, hey, you're screwing up. Maybe Patty, the mother hen, knows that Lori isn't really following along. Like, you've seen that scene with the computer, and it looked like she was kind of reading an email.
Yes.
And then she, as soon as the mother hen walks by, Lori immediately shuts the computer down real quick. Maybe because Patty knows that she's not fully, like she's involved and she's definitely committed, but there's still that one little crack there that reminds her of her husband. I think that's probably what's happening with Patty, and that's why she's just getting on her so much.
Mm. Poor Lori's husband, Kevin.
Ugh.
Did you see how many pictures he had next to his desk about the GR?
Oh, just haunting him. Just haunting him. And of course, her picture is right by his face. And he looks at it, and you can just see how awful he feels about it.
Well, her hair looks awful in that picture as well.
That was before the VO5 treatment.
Yeah, before the makeover. My goodness. So Mayor Lucy comes to visit Kevin,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, they're like old-time friends. I thought they hated each other.
Yeah, they clearly have got some history. Now, one of our listeners thought that maybe the scene where Kevin was banging the lady, like when he was talking about what he was doing.
When the departure happened.
One of our listeners thought that maybe he was banging the mayor, and that's why the mayor and Kevin have these problems. She wasn't that far off.
Hey, you know, like one genetic sequence off, because we come to find out that Mayor Lucy is instead with Kevin's dad.
What? Like, whoa.
Say that again. Yep, that's right. Kevin's dad, who is in the crazy bin.
Oh, my God. But of course, we didn't know that at the time. She's like, oh, I'm going to go visit him. And he's like, oh, tell him I say hi. And you're like, what the hell are you talking about?
That reveal was huge. Absolutely huge.
What do you think was bigger? The fact that Lori was Kevin's wife or Mayor Lucy's banging Kevin's dad.
Lori. Last week's reveal was bigger, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. The Mayor Lucy being with Kevin's dad, whatever. Kevin's dad isn't doing anything. He's hanging out in the crazy bin, talking to people. Mm-hmm. Who are these people that he's talking to, by the way? Because he somehow knows what Kevin's talking about with this mystery man.
Yeah, he is clearly involved in something. Something is definitely happening with the Garvey men. I'm gonna expand on this a little bit further in my sudden theory of the week. So I'm not going to get into it now. But something is clearly happening with them.
The thing, though, is that the mayor seems to be okay with the fact that both the father and Kevin are kind of losing their marbles a little bit. She even says something about how Kevin's killing dogs. So somehow word has gotten out that this dog last week was dead. And
or multiple dogs.
Yeah, and people are now pointing the fingers at the police chief and trying to keep it under wraps to help protect him. And he keeps telling everyone, no, it's this guy that has a truck. Sure enough, the truck is in his yard.
Oh,
how embarrassing is that?
And like his subordinate discovers the truck in his yard. And the guy's like trying to help him out. He's like, I'll just tell him that we found it abandoned in a couple of streets over. And Kevin's like, what are you talking about, dude? This ain't my truck. Somebody left it here. And you can see the trepidation in his subordinate's face, like, all right, man, no, yeah, okay, it was somebody put it here, dude, no problem. Like, you can see that he clearly knows the history behind Kevin's family and the dad and everything. He believes that Kevin's going nuts.
Why do you think if his subordinate, if this police officer and if the mayor think that Kevin's starting to lose it, why are they still letting him be police chief?
I have no idea. Maybe because they're seeing signs, but there's no real definitive proof. Yes, all these dead dogs were there. And I loved how the first opening scene was was Kevin at the scene. And people being like, hey, where is this guy that you were talking about? There's no truck. There's just dead dogs and you. You're starting to see some cracks. And everybody knows the history, so nobody really wants to believe it quite yet. But they're starting to see the foundations falter, I think.
The thing that really shook the foundation, because now at this point you're starting to believe that Kevin is the only one killing these dogs, mm-hmm. that he somehow found this truck, put it in his yard. But then the mystery man shows up, they're chatting. Kevin, you can tell he's looking at this guy, and the guy's saying, let's go kill some more dogs. I found a bunch of them. They're hanging out. But Jill shows up with Amy. Mm-hmm. And Jill takes a pack of beer from this mystery guy. And afterwards, because at first I thought, okay, the mystery guy still isn't there. I bet you Kevin is holding the beer. Mm-hmm. And she grabs it from him and says, is this for us? And he's like, yeah. Or he says, no, actually. And she goes on inside. And in my head, I'm thinking, okay, I still don't believe in the mystery man. But then Jill turns around and says, hey, Dad, who was that? Who are you talking to?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to expand on this in my sudden theory of the week. So I'm not going to talk about it quite yet. But I'm going to say one thing. I'm going to tease it. I'm going to give you the professional tease. You ready?
Yes.
There's more to that than meets the eye. I promise you, and I'm going to get into it further.
All right. So Jill comes home, possibly sees this guy. Interesting, interesting, interesting.
And I also want to get into this too when actually Kevin was with the mayor at the police station. The whole debacle with the bagel. Was the bagel real? Did it disappear? Did he actually put it in there? The whole episode you're thinking, nah, this bagel wasn't there, dude. Because even the mayor is like, what bagel are you talking about? I didn't take your bagel. Like, what are you talking about? He goes back eventually and he finds the bagel. So it makes you think that he's not crazy, that it was there. And he freaked out on him. He took the whole thing apart and he deconstructed his own mortality, really, in that toaster. He deconstructed his own mental instability.
I still don't think the bagel was there.
You don't think so?
No.
Wow.
I don't.
Because only he found it.
Because when my bagels got stuck in those toasters, they caught on fire.
I didn't see no fire bursting out of
no,
that thing.
I had that same kind of toaster in college, and I had got a couple pieces of toast stuck, and there was some smoke and fire. Okay, so maybe there was a bagel there, but I'm just being straight with you. If that really happened, there would have been some smoke.
Mm-hmm. How about Wayne kissing that dead guy?
He like kissed him and kind of licked him a little bit. There was a little tongue.
Ugh.
Who
does that?
Wayne does. Now, was that his guard or was that some just random dead guy?
That was one of his guards.
That was Peter Berg.
That was Peter Berg, the director. The guy who directed that episode. Wasn't that crazy?
So he pretty much, Wayne was like, I bet you it was written in his notes, like, Wayne needs to go and carefully kiss the dead guy as a thank you. And whoever this character Wayne is was like, all right, no problem. And he just wanted to mess with Peter Berg and was like, you need to stay in dead character, buddy, because here I come.
I'm going
to
come make out with
and
you with no shirt on.
And he came over with, like, licking, no shirt on. My goodness gracious. That was just disgusting.
All right, can we talk about after that scene? I know the kissing the dead guy was weird, but let's talk about Wayne and Tom's interaction. What is happening with this hugging thing? I was really like, are they really going to show him hugging Tom? Is that really going to happen?
It almost didn't even seem like a hug. Like, I kind of expected almost like a kiss. Do you remember that scene in The Green Mile where the guy has to actually take his mouth over the woman with cancer and he sucks out the cancer,
yes,
through his mouth?
Okay, yeah.
I almost thought Wayne was going in for a kiss with Tom.
So you know what we should do? We should just call Wayne John Coffey from now on. What do you think?
But I like John Coffey and I don't like Wayne.
I know, Wayne's weird, especially with no shirt.
Yeah, I'm just gross. But that's what I thought. I thought he was going to come in for this weird kiss hug, especially after kissing that other guy's face. Oh, then Wayne is like, oh, Tom, you're going to go take care of Christine. Let me give you some money. He lifts up his car seat, has bajillions of dollars taped underneath, and he only gives him one pack. I mean, granted, that's probably what, $1 million?
Well, no, the one pack's probably about $1,000, I bet.
That's it.
But where is he getting all that money from?
Oh, from congressmen.
Yeah, oh, that's true. Yeah.
Wayne is loaded beyond belief. However, if Christine is the most important thing in the world, can't you throw a couple more G's at her? I see it all under there.
Especially for the guy that you hand picked to protect Christine.
And he wants him to stay in a different hotel each night. Do you understand how much work that's going to be for a travel agent? I mean, really?
I'm going to tell you, I don't think he's staying at like the Hilton or the Omni. He's a Motel 8 guy.
Oh,
I can feel that. Maybe a Motel 6.
We'll leave the light on for you.
I'll go that far. But why did he pick Tom to do this? And he tells you immediately, because he's the one motherfucker that he can't figure out. And that's why he picks him to protect Christine, because she's got like these special powers. What is it? That is just maddening. I want to know what the deal is with Christine.
Wayne is just nasty. I bet you there isn't even anything with Christine. I'm just so grossed out with how inappropriate Wayne is. I think Tom and Christine should get together. They're at least an appropriate age.
Well, at least he gives her gummy worms.
We don't even know how old she is. Is she 16? Is she even legal?
No, she's not. She is 16. They mentioned
oh,
that
goodness
in the
gracious.
In the Aftec.
Okay, thing. Christine needs to have. She needs to go to Disney or something that is just very PG rated. Girlfriend needs to get away and eat more gummy worms. She's pumped for the road trip, by the way.
I know.
Did you see how Tom, he's so nervous. He understands the weight of the situation. She's pumped. She's like ready for road snacks. She probably wants to go see the biggest ball of yarn on their travels.
Biggest frying pan.
Yeah, yeah. She is excited for a road trip. And that right there shows her innocence even more.
That she's just a small kid. She doesn't even know what she's getting herself into. And I love that idea against what Tom was doing. The car wouldn't start and he freaks out because he feels all of the weight falling on him. He's already left his family. His family fell apart. Now this thing with Wayne is falling apart. He's given himself to college. That fell apart. And he's failing at everything. And now he can't even start a goddamn car. So it was awesome the way that he freaked out like that. I thought that was fantastic.
I would do the same thing. When I saw him freak out like that, I was like, I would be doing the same thing if everything just happened to me and Wayne just tried to kiss hug me. Disgusting.
I also want to talk about Lori and Meg. I want to get back to this. This show so far is definitely about Kevin. It's about the Garvey family. But the biggest thing I took from this episode was Meg and her transformation of going from a normal person to kind of becoming one of the GR. You see it physically throughout the whole show. The first time she chops down, well, she's trying to chop down the tree, it's like weak and feeble, and she's crying and she gives up. She's got blisters on her hands and she's just like, I'm tired of chopping down trees. What is this supposed to be, a metaphor for letting go of my former life? Like, all condescending. But then at the end of the episode, you see her actually go back out there and start wailing this thing. And smiling and laughing and being a lot more forceful, you see that her transition this character, Meg, is going to be a lot bigger part of the show than I originally anticipated. It's not just because Liv Tyler was cast as Meg, I don't think. I mean, it's obviously important because Liv Tyler was cast. But I thought it was going to be one of those kind of minor roles that she'd be in and out, and she'd only work for a little bit, and that'd be that. But Meg is going to be a much larger part of this show.
What I loved is actually that conversation, if you can even call it that, conversation between Laurie and Meg.
Yes.
And when Meg talked about seeing the hot cop and realizing that that was Laurie's husband. And she asked her, you know, how could you leave him? And Laurie writes down, I remember.
Yes.
And that was so powerful. And once again, it made me feel so sad. As I told you in the beginning, I'm not in love with this show yet because I'm such an optimistic person. I don't read sad novels. I don't watch sad shows. And this show is depressed.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Guilty Remnant people are. A lot of them to me are just so depressed, mm-hmm. and they are accepting it and they're accepting their depression. And I think that that's it. When Meg was chopping down that tree, it was chopping down the mask that she's had to try to wear for 3 years.
Especially planning that wedding.
Exactly. You know, it's, oh, everything's going to be fine. We can plan this wedding. We can live happily ever after.
It'll make me happy.
And it didn't. And it wasn't going to. And I loved how happy she was chopping it down at the end, because it was her way of being able to say, I can accept what's happened. Yeah. I can be okay with the fact that I am sad. And I'm not saying that I would be joining the Guilty Remnant. I don't want to eat that gross oatmeal every single day. I hate the color white. But, you know, it was a lighter side of the Guilty Remnant. It was these two souls. And you just feel sad. It's like, you know, I feel like Mapleton dropped the ball. Obviously, their therapists suck. It's like they need better therapists, better group therapy for the people who are still suffering. There's no center for them, and they end up joining the Guilty Remnant.
Well, is this indicative of the Guilty Remnant, or is this more a derivative of the relationship that Meg and Laurie are forming? Again, we talked about Meg possibly bringing out the pretty hair out of Laurie, or is Laurie doing the thing for Meg? But either way, there is some kind of compassion there for the both of them. When she says, I remember, you could see it in her face that she does remember, that she hates it, but she lives with it and she surrenders to it. And that's what she ends up telling Meg. She has to surrender. It's for a bigger purpose. And then ultimately, when Meg has to give up her mom's little piece of clothing, she smells it and she doesn't want to feel this way anymore. Of course, what way is that? Is it the depression, or is it the angst, or is it just something that is just overall bad? She doesn't want to feel like it anymore. She ends up realizing she does have to surrender. She does have to give up that item, and she does have to join the Guilty Remnant. But maybe it's because of the relationship she's creating with Laurie. And I think that's why this character, Meg, is going to be so big, because it's either going to solidify the Guilty Remnant for us as viewers, or it's going to bring out something in Laurie that we're not anticipating in terms of her marriage with Kevin. It's going to soften the blow. It's going to soften that cold iciness that Laurie and Kevin share, and maybe bring them back together.
One can wish.
Oh.
One can have hope.
We need like the fairy godmother music now. You know?
And then I can say I'm in love with it because it's a happy ending.
Let's talk about Kevin and his dad in that scene in the nut house when Kevin goes to visit him.
Let me tell you, TV shows recently, daddy issues.
Oh.
Up and down. Game of Thrones, first off, daddy issues.
Huge daddy issues.
I mean, I feel like every show has daddy issues.
Especially a Damon Lindelof show.
Oh,
like
God,
Lost.
Yes.
Can we just talk about the amount of daddy issues on Lost?
I think Damon needs a hug. Maybe he has some daddy issues that he's writing about throughout all of these characters.
I totally agree with that one. I love what's happening in this scene. I love what's happening.
Break it down for me. Why?
Okay. First of all, you see Perfect Strangers playing in the background. How cool is that? Seeing Balky and everybody. Loved Perfect Strangers as a kid. Thought it was so funny that they call out to that. And it's, of course, it's a little bit on the nose, but it's symbolic of Kevin and his dad. They are perfect strangers. They're son and father. They are related. they are together, but they don't know each other really. They know is, I'm your dad, I'm your son, and I know that you're kind of screwed up, Dad. But the funny thing is that the dad knows that Kevin is screwed up.
How does he know that?
He's heard about the dogs through Mayor Lucy, and he also sees Kevin living in his house, the dad's house, having the dad's job, the former job, and he knows that Kevin is there because Kevin never visits, and he's only there because, I gotta know what the hell's happened to me, Dad. When did you start to lose your shit? What was it like? And the father has the answers for him. Well, kind of. He thinks that he's totally sane. And you kind of almost believe him. You kind of almost do, because he's like, contrary to everybody's opinion, I still got my marbles. Of course, then he starts talking to nobody.
Yeah, and you like remember back to the shots of him being naked, just running around.
Yeah, but you wanted to believe that like that was just a momentary lapse in judgment, or maybe he got drunk one day. Like,
Nikki time. Everyone yeah. wants some Nikki time. But he does. He starts talking to nobody, and he's arguing with these voices like, why do I always have to tell him? Oh, da, 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 da. But then he says something that hits a little bit on the nose. He tells Kevin, they want me to tell you that someone's going to be coming to help you.
Yeah, they've sent or they are sending someone to help you.
But you need to keep it on the DL.
Yeah, keep it to yourself, bro.
So is this person that people are sending, is it this mystery man who wants to kill dogs?
Well, that's the thing I think that they're probably alluding to, or at least that's what Kevin thinks. So, okay, some crazy mystery person is speaking to Kevin's dad. Now we have this mystery man speaking to Kevin.
We need to name the mystery man something. Can we call him Dog Killer?
Dog? No, that name sucks.
But that's what he does. That's literally all he wants to do. That's like what he loves in life. He finds packs of dogs to kill.
Can we call him Baldy? Let's call him Baldy. Because he's bald.
Bald Dog Killer.
That's awful.
Okay.
All right, we'll come back to that.
I just feel like there's going to be a lot of mystery people coming up in this show, yeah. And mystery is too vague.
Well, so look, Baldy and whatever his name is, Bald Dog Killer.
Yes.
He is connected somehow to all of this. And whether or not you want to believe the guy's real or not, he is connected. And it's not a coincidence that this guy shows up on Kevin's doorstep right before Kevin goes to see his dad, and his dad's like, hey, there's someone showing up, and they're there to help you. First of all, who is Kevin's dad talking to? Help with what? What is happening here?
They need the Long Island medium. She's in the same state.
I'm feeling a lot of fur. I'm feeling fur on my neck and a gun, like something piercing through my skull. What's happening here?
If you haven't seen Long Island Medium, just YouTube it.
Oh, my God.
I've seen her in real life. Girlfriend's real.
She is nuts.
She's real, and she is really nuts. That's they should have an episode where she goes and visits, and she's going to clear all this stuff up for them. The leftovers, she'll figure out where they are.
All right, and then I also just want to finish off with this, too. Seeing him find the bagel at the end in the toaster, I thought it was very cathartic. It was cathartic for me as a viewer. I thought it was cathartic for Kevin as a character. I wanted to believe that Kevin's not crazy. And maybe this bagel thing, maybe it's Lindelof saying, hey guys, a bagel is just a bagel. Yes, I know I taught you to look for everything in Lost, but calm down. Maybe Lindelof is issuing a calm down to all of us. I think that's what's happening with that.
I don't think the bagel was there. He was the only person in the room when he found that bagel.
That's true. That's a very valid point.
I think Kevin is as kooky as his dad.
And then, again, seeing Meg with the chopping down the tree. First of all, okay, whoa, whoa, whoa. That axe is never going to chop through that enormous tree. And maybe that's part of the deal, too, from the GR. Maybe they gave her this little freaking axe. And they're like, hey, go chop that thing down, knowing that she'll never, ever, ever, ever be able to do it. It's just one of those things that she just has to surrender to it.
It's just something to get out her aggression. You know what it is? That is her penguin. That's what she gets to punch.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
She doesn't get to punch a penguin. She gets to chop at a huge tree.
All right. What do you say we get to listener feedback?
All right. Give it to me.
I had a really good conversation on Twitter with Caitlin at Fairly Certain. We were actually kind of going back and forth. It got a little heated there for a second. We were talking about Lori and why she gave up on the family. And, you know, Caitlin was tweeting to us, you know, people who lost nothing are weak. If I lost nothing, I wouldn't be running from what they're lucky to have. And it seems that the GR, they recruit members by stalking and intimidation until they break down the weakest minded ones. So she's saying that Lori is a selfish bitch, essentially, and that she never would have given up on her family the way that Lori did. I think this is a little unfair to say, Caitlin, because you don't know Lori's situation. You don't know why she went to the GR yet. You haven't seen that flashback. You don't know, just because she lost somebody or she didn't lose somebody, that doesn't mean she didn't lose something. Maybe she watched her family fall apart right in front of her eyes. She saw her son skip college. She sees her daughter falling apart right in front of her. And then who knows what happened with Kevin? Maybe something happened and her life fell apart, and maybe she couldn't turn to anything else but the GR. That's why I have a problem with that assessment.
I don't know. We don't know what would happen, but I also know that there are some people who do have really strong relationships who would view Lori in a bad way. I would love for Lori, as you're hoping, I would hope for Lori to turn her back on the GR.
And she's going to. I guarantee it.
Oh, one day we can hope. Well, Emma Harita, she tweeted that she was trying to figure out what Lori wrote to Meg. Her last note was too small for her to read. It says surrender.
Yes, it says surrender. That's what she wanted Meg to do. At the very end, she's like, how do you deal with this? How do you deal with remembering your previous life? And then she puts on the paper, surrender.
And Kathy says on Twitter that they moved to Sharpies after this episode, like big fat Sharpies, not even real regular Sharpies. You know what they moved to? They moved to almost whiteboard markers, but they don't write on whiteboards. They're writing on paper. Anyway, they're writing in these big markers because they realized that we, as the viewers, couldn't read what they were writing in these little pens.
What a great piece of information. For anybody that's not following this lady, Kath Lingenfelter, one of the writers on the show, please follow this lady. She has great tidbits of information.
And if you don't follow her, we're going to give you our favorite bits like this. Oh, yeah. The fact that they've now switched to Sharpies.
Hey, speaking of Twitter, by the way, The Leftovers, the official Leftovers HBO Twitter account, is now following us, The Living Reminders,
Woo-hoo!
On Twitter.
Thank you.
I thought that was really cool. And for those of you who watch Game of Thrones, the podcast, the best podcast for Game of Thrones, Game of Owns, is also following us. To my knowledge, is listening to our show as we even speak this very word right here. So, guys, I want to say thank you so much. We love your show.
Guys and gal.
Oh, guys and gal. That's true. We love your show. We listen to you every single week, and we cannot wait for you guys to come back on. I cannot wait. If you want, come on our show and talk about the Leftovers. I think that'd be awesome.
So just talking about podcasts, we wanted to let all of you know that if you're listening to us on iTunes, we would just love for you to rate and review us and just to spread the love of The Living Reminders. You just literally need to go type in Living Reminders and you can rate and review us 5 stars. And the good thing about it is that you can spread the love and let others know about this podcast.
That's right. We actually got a good review on iTunes from a user, PVD3384. He said that he discovered us on our other podcast, ParentCast. So go listen to us on that one. It's all about our kid and our crazy lives together. He's never been a huge podcast guy until his wife made him listen to a whole bunch of them when he had his first kid recently. But however, he is into HBO programming. So when he found out that we were doing this podcast, Living Reminders, he immediately tuned in. He says that not only were we funny, but we have a lot of personality, great chemistry, and are very insightful about the show, The Leftovers. No detail is missed. Our reheating The Leftovers and sudden theory of the week, which we're about to get to. Those segments are awesome, so do yourself a favor and listen to The Leftovers and tune in to Mary and Blake. They'll make it a much better experience.
Aw, thanks so much, PVD. That
is awesome.
Yeah, thank you. That's awesome to hear.
That's like the nicest thing everyone's ever said about me.
If I'm just asking if people do write in reviews, we'd like to know even what your least favorite part is. I want to know what we can do to get better. I want to have more of these kind of feedback. You guys are great.
Yeah, if so we suck, tell
what
us.
If one of... the things that he mentioned is a sudden theory of the week. So if you're tuning in, this is the first time that you're chatting, like listening to us.
Yep.
Sudden theory of the week is when Blake and I are going to let you know what we think the mystery behind The Leftovers is.
All right, let's get into it. All right, Marvin, what's your sudden theory of the week?
The mysterious bald dog gunman is still completely Kevin. And I think when Kevin was looking for beer, he just like picked one up somewhere. He picked up a six pack. Jill came in, grabbed it from Kevin. They go on inside. And then when she says, "Who are you talking to?" And we're supposed to think, "Oh, she can see the guy too." I think Kevin was just talking to nobody. And I think
and that's why she was all screwed up about it. Like, "Hey, bro, who are you talking to?"
Yeah. Like, are you talking to is someone out there? So I still don't think that anyone else sees this bald, dead killing man, a dog killer. Mm-hmm. I think that it is still Kevin.
Okay. My sudden theory of the week is similar but different. I guarantee Jill has the same disease as Kevin.
Disease? Like mental disease?
Mental disease.
Same thing that their grandfather has?
Oh, it's not just about the Garvey men. It's actually about the Garveys themselves with that family. I guarantee you she has the same thing as Kevin. Now, okay, yes, she has the beer, okay? She gets the beer from Baldy, right? But maybe you're right. Maybe she does get it from Kevin. That could happen. She sees the mystery man. She sees Baldy. But you know who doesn't see Baldy? Amy, the friend. Amy, if you notice, I watched it 3 times. Does not even acknowledge Baldy. Doesn't even look at him. Doesn't say anything to him. Doesn't even see that he's there. It reminded me a lot of The Sixth Sense with Bruce Willis. When people would like ignore him and he'd be all jerked off about it. Be like, "Dude, why are you ignoring me, bro? What's your problem?" But because they didn't even see him. They didn't even know he was there.
Oh my God, is he one of the people? Are they actually not off of this world? Are they like ghosts?
You think Baldy is one of the people that disappeared?
Yeah. Oh my God. Could Kevin and Jill and his dad be like Haley Joel Osment?
"I see dead people."
That's awesome. We just had like the greatest combined sudden theory of the week.
I love it.
Please hang up and try again.
This is awesome.
I love it. Well, we want to know what your sudden theories of the week are. We want to know what you think about our ideas. There are all tons of different ways you guys can get in touch with us. You can visit us online at our website. It is thelivingreminders.com.
You can also get us on Facebook at facebook.com/livingreminders.
Our Twitter handle, we tweet a lot during the show afterwards. This is how we already got a lot of great feedback from Emma and from Caitlin this week. So we would love to hear from you guys. Our Twitter handle is @livingreminders.
Take part in that epic live tweet during the show. We're totally doing it. I absolutely love it. I don't do it. My beautiful wife across from me does it.
You try to participate.
A little bit. I do a little bit before the show. I'm not a Twitter guy. I'm a Facebook guy. So if anybody really ever replies to you on Facebook, it's me. I guarantee it. You can also get us at Gmail at thelivingreminders@gmail.com.
And if you want to join in the conversation with your voice, we would love to hear you, honestly. Whether you tweet to us, whether you write us an email or you Facebook us, but if you want to call in and leave like a minute or so feedback or your theory of the week, we actually have a hotline. It's free for you guys. Just go to our website, thelivingreminders.com, and on the right-hand side, you'll see this button. Mm-hmm. And you can just record right from your computer. That way we can hear your voice. We can have a really cool, unique conversation with you. And it just brings our podcast to a whole nother level.
Or you can even call the number on the website as well. And it'll call straight into a Google Voice. It'll ring for you, but it won't ring over here. We're not going to answer the phone and be like, "Hey, what's going on?"
Unless you want to. And then you could send us an email and we can have a whole little conversation.
Yeah, that's totally up to you. But it will go straight to voicemail and you can leave the voicemail for us and it will show up on the air. So please get in touch with us. Give us that feedback. That'd be awesome.
All right, everyone. We are really excited to hear from you this week. Get in that listener feedback and stay tuned for next week.
Next week's show is going to be all about Matt Jameson, the Reverend. I can't wait for that. I'm not going to get into the details, but it's going to be about that guy and his story. They've been teasing him, and I can't wait to see what he has to say and what's going to happen with that burning house. What's going to go on with that in the preview?
Just not like fire.
Way too much fire in this show.
Seriously.
All right, guys. All right, guys. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone. This is Mary.
This is Blake.
And we are the Living Reminders.